Welcome to Dad's on the Air for the 7th of August 2007. Got an interesting show coming up. We have Alan Turner. He's the Chief Executive of the Zadie Rainbow Foundation. They're promoting organ transplants to sign up in hospitals for organ transplants. That should be a very moving interview. I've heard him speak before, and a very powerful speaker he is. We've also got John Ashfield. He's the author of a number of books, including Matters for Men, The Nature of Men, and Looking After Your Family. He's a men's health expert from South Australia. He's done some wonderful work down there on men's issues. That should be a very interesting interview as well. We've got Harry Hill. He's the author of a new book, He Was My Father. Harry's a walking encyclopedia on the issues, on the whole history of the national parks in the Alpine area here in Australia. We'd like to welcome all those people who are joining us from around the world now via live streaming, the marvels of modern technology. You can now listen to us in Siberia, if you're in Siberia, via live streaming on our website, on the station's website, which is, of course, 893fm.com.au.
So, I believe you can even hear us in Tasmania, John.
We are having some difficulties with the shows, putting them up onto our dadsontheair.net website, so they're not going up as rapidly as we would like. The last week's show has still not gone up, and this week's show will also be delayed due to various technical difficulties. We are unfunded, we're a group of volunteers, and sometimes reality gets in the way. We'll also have, I think, have we got Greg Anderson on the line? I don't know. I haven't got a microphone here. But hopefully sooner or later we'll have Greg Anderson calling in from the UK. Also,
hello,
some interesting stuff. Dad's on the Air has been asked to speak at the Lone Fathers Association conference, which will be on in August next. Sorry, we're just getting the microphone organised here.
Yes, getting organised here in the studio.
Which will be here on the 8th and 9th of August. It's the Lone Fathers Conference, and it's asking the question, has the Howard government's family law reforms been a success? Do we or do we not have Greg Anderson on the line?
Hello, John.
Ah, Greg, good on you. You're calling in from the UK, you glamorous person, you.
I've been travelling around a bit, yeah. I'm in London at the moment. And finally, the sun is shining after the biggest floods they've had in living memory, and we're having a bit of a summer here at last, thank goodness.
Right, so you've been running around doing some great work for us and some interviews that we will be able to hear in the coming weeks. Can you just give us an idea what's coming up?
Absolutely. I headed up to interview Ray Barry, who's the religious and political coordinator for Fathers for Justice in the United Kingdom. I'm sure that most of our listeners would have heard of Fathers for Justice. They're a fantastic group of activists over here in the UK who do all sorts of fantastic stunts.
Yes, the most famous for climbing up on Buckingham Palace and that
dressed
sort of
as Batman,
thing.
Yeah.
I don't think Australian dads are quite that gregarious or flamboyant. I don't know that they're going to get up to that sort of thing over here.
No, I must say, after meeting some of the guys over here, us Australians seem to appear quite dull and demure and almost formal in our forms of protest.
I don't know, Greg. We early on there was a few judges blown up and that sort of thing, so I think it might be more extreme over here.
That was some decades ago, right, Pete.
Yes, it was.
I'll tell you what, we could certainly learn a lot from the Fathers for Justice blokes. One of the other guys I met up with was Jolly Stainsby. He's probably one of the most infamous of them. I'll tell you about a few of his stunts include... He painted his entire flock of sheep purple because that's the colour that Fathers for Justice have chosen.
It's purple hearts.
The colour of equality. So scaling the roof of the Royal Courts of Justice in London dressed as Batman and Robin. He spent 7 days in sub-zero temperatures on Tamar Bridge in Plymouth and then enraged the police by cleverly eluding capture. And one of his more interesting stunts was... appearing at his own court case dressed entirely as in drag as a woman in the hope that switching genders would help to bring in some justice. So they're very humorous and very great stunts and great forms of activism. I hope that some of us Australians can learn a lot from those guys.
Right. And what was the general feeling that you got about all this over there?
Well, I actually, in terms of the family court system over here, I've come out of it thinking that we've actually got it pretty good in Australia. The family court system here is completely secretive. I know the Australian system is fairly secret, but over here, one of the other guys I met up with, Mark Harris, he's just published his book called Family Court Hell. He's the first person in history, so basically in the 30 years of the family court here, he's the first person who's ever told a public story of what's going on inside the courts, because they've been completely shut, completely secret for all that time.
No one can report on them.
Sorry?
He was jailed for 9 months,
Jailed for 9 months for the crime of waving to his daughters. It took him 10 years, 133 court appearances before 33 different judges, two prison sentences and a hunger strike before he was given permission to be with his daughters again. And his daughters now live with him. It's an incredible story of courage and determination, as well as a complete indictment of the British family law system.
And a rare happy ending.
Sorry? Yes, luckily a happy ending. Otherwise, I don't know what he would have done. The reforms we've had in Australia, even though they've been small and slow in coming, they are miles ahead of anything that's happened here. Even though Fathers for Justice have been doing these incredible stunts, they're a household name over here. For the past 4 or 5 years they've been active, there has been no legal change whatsoever. So it's not looking all that good over here, and it probably gives us cause for optimism in Australia.
Well, as you know, we're speaking. There'll be a Lone Fathers conference down in Canberra where we'll be speaking this week, and I'm somewhat nervous about facing the pack, I guess. But anyway, we'll manage.
I'm sure you will. I'm sure you'll do us all proud, John.
Right. So anything else you want to tell us before you go?
Look, not really. I'm heading back this weekend, so I'll be back in the studio with you guys for next week's show. And I guess I just want to wish you the best of luck for the conference down in Canberra. Today and tomorrow, you're heading down after the show, right?
We are indeed.
Very excellent. Well, all the best for that, and I'll catch up with you guys next week.
Thank you very much. That was Greg Anderson, our roving reporter. He's and also the show's main researcher. Got a good, solid academic background to him. We'll be back shortly, and we'll be talking with Alan Turner. He's the chief executive of the Zadie Rainbow Foundation.
The empty house. No family, no wife. I can stay up all night, I can run round in the nude. I can eat steak or any other type of food. I don't have to go and buy her flowers. Don't have to be early, I don't have to be late. I'm Daddy Immaculate. I'm Daddy Immaculate. Come to a funny girl. I'm Daddy Immaculate, coming to a Pondago. I'm Daddy Immaculate, I'm coming to a Pondago. Cause I just said her bum looks big in this. Nobody to love, chair. Nobody to try and tell me to cut my hair. Nobody to play with. Nobody to fight. Nobody to keep me warm at night.
And that was Daddy Immaculate by Horizon Shine. You're listening to Dad's on the Air, and in the studio with me this morning I have the guru of the Father's Movement, John Stapleton, all the way from Redfern, and of course Peter Vandervoorde is also in here in the studio with us this morning, and of course I am Ian Purdy, so you're listening to Dad's on the Air.
Good morning, Ian.
And we have on the line Alan Turner from the Zadie Foundation. You there, Alan?
Good morning, gentlemen.
Thank you very much. Now, look, can we just start at the beginning, I guess? You've it's such a difficult story to tell. You've become one of the major supporters of organ transplants. I guess if you could just start at the very beginning. Your family signed up for to be organ transplant. How did that happen for a start?
Well, that's correct, John. In the year 2000, my wife received back an updated registration form to be a donor, and on that form there was provision for the family to be signed up, and at the time we thought, yeah, why not? We'll all sign up. Our children at that age was 3 and 5, our daughter 3 and our son 5, and we thought it was just a thing to do, just in case. We talked about it in depth, and we made that decision as a family that we would all be registered just in case something happened to us. And never to think that in the year 2004 our young daughter Zadie died suddenly and became an organ and tissue donor at the time.
And how, where did the name Zadie come from, just for a start? What does it mean?
We found Zadie's name in a naming book, and it means smiling princess. And also Sarah in French.
And the
name certainly suited our daughter. She was always smiling.
Always smiling, and the pictures of her, she was an enormously lively character, full of life, full of love.
Yes.
And how did she die?
On the Thursday night, or the Wednesday night actually, on the 1st of December in 2004, she raced out of her bedroom and complained of a severe pain in her head. And she said, "It's killing me." In fact, moments after that, she collapsed unconsciously in my wife's arms. We rushed her to the local hospital, and they did an MRI scan and discovered a large bleed in her brain. We live in Shepparton, middle Victoria, and they called instantly for their ambulance to fly her up, or fly her out of Shepparton's the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne. Performed emergency surgery, brain surgery on her to relieve the pressure in her brain and see if anything could be done. And the news wasn't good. They came back and said, "Look, prepare yourself. She may never come out of surgery." They went back a second time, and this was very, very late at night. And they said, "She's not going to come out of surgery. She's going to die. There's nothing that can be done to save Sadie's life."
Oh,
and I guess through that grief and tragedy, and our whole body and mind was just shaking like anything. And it was such a surreal moment that you'd never pitch yourself that you'd be in that situation, especially with your child.
Mm.
And my wife turned around to the doctors at the time and said, Zadie's going to be a donor and donate all her organ and tissues to others, and we did.
That's unbelievable. And I've asked you these questions before, but there are a lot of sort of practical things that people would worry about as to why. Well, first up, you found that there's almost nobody and no children are registered on the organ transplant. That the fact that you as a family made this decision was incredibly rare and incredibly important to others.
Yes, John. Up until July 2005, the government changed the rules on the registration, so children aren't allowed to be registered at the moment. Being the case that any child under the age of 18 still needs parents to consent, the new rules and regulations allow adults, any person over the age of 18, doesn't require parents or family consent to be a donor if they die. But the more high statistic and incredible statistic was, only a few days after we left the hospital, that they came back to us and said that in that year, 2004, Zadie was the only child under the age of 16 to be an organ and tissue donor in that state. And, around about 20 to 30 kids around the country die every year. And of that year, only 6 children in Australia were donors. And when you think of how many children die in hospitals, unfortunately, in the Royal Children's that year in 2004, 102 other children died. And I can imagine the hospitals in New South Wales and Queensland would have probably more, especially New South Wales, have a higher statistic of children dying. And the ability of those children to die to be an organ and tissue donor is very high. But unfortunately, we as a family, or we as parents, don't talk about it on a regular basis. So our whole campaign is to tell people about Zadie's story and encourage families to consider organ and tissue donation after the death of a loved one, because there's more people out there that need your organ and tissues than you do after death.
What are the child donor numbers at the moment, Alan?
Well, they don't have an exact child numbers at the moment, or halfway through the year, but it's not looking good. The last year, I think, or 2005, after Zadie's death, there was an incredible increase in donor rate, and we're hoping that telling Zadie's story and making people aware that influenced that. There was 15 children in 2005 that donated. In 2006, that number went down again, and we're not looking good this year for children to break the double-figure mark in donating around the country.
And during that appalling period when your daughter died, I think you said that there were other families, that her organs were rushed to these desperate families within the hospital.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a Confidentiality Act that they don't inform donor families where the organ tissue went to. It's a matter of receiving letters or information back from LifeGift that coordinate the organ and tissues. But yes, Zadie donated both her corneas to 2 small children that had eye problems since birth. She donated a kidney, both her kidneys, to a middle-aged mother of all things who was on dialysis for 6 years. She donated a heart valve to a newborn baby and a heart patch to an infant that came out of their mother in need of desperate surgery. And in that sort of situation, if Zadie didn't die and wasn't a donor, those 2 young children may have died as well as a result of not receiving an organ or tissue. And she donated her liver to an 8-year-old girl who was very, very sick. Through our tragedy and our loss, it was great news for other families and other kids out there to have a second chance in life in most cases, or improve their life dramatically through just the result of a child being a donor.
We're talking with Alan Turner. He's the Chief Executive of the Zadie Rainbow Foundation. We'll be back in a moment.
and gather round people wherever you want. And admit that the waters around you are warm. Except that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming. You sink like a stone, for the times they are changing. Come mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging, so get out your new mind. You can't lend a hand, for the times they are changing.
Talking with Alan Turner. He's the Chief Executive of the Zadie Rainbow Foundation. Welcome back to the show, Alan.
Thanks, John.
Now, in practical terms, what should people do?
It's a simple thing. It's called talking and understanding the family's wishes, or your fathers, your mothers, your daughters, your sons, your sisters, your brothers. Talking to them about the subject and understanding if anything happened in your family, would they be keen to be an organ and tissue donor or not. The last place you want to make a decision is on the deathbed of a child or mother or father. It's a subject that we're promoting to talk about beforehand. It's a bit like car insurance. No one jumps in their car and goes down the street or goes to work without insurance on their car just in case. We want this subject to be very high profile around the kitchen table and in schools and in the community in general, is that it's an easy subject to talk about because children aren't scared about death. It's only us parents that think that we shouldn't involve our kids about this subject. I do many, many schools, and the questions that come out of grade 3 and 4 and those kids all thirst for more information about what organ and tissue donation is all about, what Zadie gave, why she gave, how she died. So, yeah, it's talking about it and making sure that it is a subject that everyone in the family is aware of, just in case.
Now, one of the things that will concern families is just the state of the body. Do they get back sort of something that looks like...
John, there's a lot of myth about organ and tissue donors. I think the American programs that we see have got a lot to be desired about how they get the message across. When Zadie went in for her final operation at the Royal Children's Hospital, she came back to us with a band-aid from her throat or voice box to a belly button, and that was it. There was a band-aid, a bandage all the way through. We held her for an hour after she came back to us, after she died, and she weighed the same, she looked the same. There was no visual impact of her being an organ and tissue donor after that. They do it very professionally and sensitively. It is just like a normal operation. You would not have told, you would not tell that she donated all those organ and tissues after she came back to us.
Right. And how did you set up this organisation? It must have been out of all this distress and turmoil. How did you go, how did it all come about, the Zadie Rainbow Foundation?
Well, I think, you know, when we did come back to Shepparton and understand the subject a bit more, and that statistic of Zadie having been the only child to be a donor, we thought that can't be right. There's got to be more children that donate after death, understanding how many children do die around the country. And we discovered that there was not a lot of people out there promoting organ and tissue donation on a national scale day after day after day, you know. And also, we also discovered that there is no national symbol where the community can buy and purchase and support. So we come up with the idea of Zadie's Rainbow Shoelaces. And I was doing all this in working a full-time job and, you know, doing weekends and late at night, talking to people, raising the awareness both here in Shepparton and Victoria and right around the country. And then we made a decision that we'd form a foundation in Zadie's memory called Zadie's Rainbow Foundation. And on the July last year, in 2006, I was successful in receiving a federal government grant from the Department of Health and Ageing to turn me into the full-time CEO. So I can now drive it full-time, getting Zadie's message out there and hopefully increasing or assisting to increase the organ and tissue donation rate around this country through Zadie's memory and story.
Now, you've managed to get some very high-profile people on board. Tell us about that.
Well, we have. The first person we got on board was a gentleman called Craig Kelly, an ex-Collingwood footballer who runs elite sports properties and manages many sporting people around the country. And through Craig's business, Elite Sports Properties, they developed our website, gave us direction. And then Tom Lonigan, the AFL footballer who lost his kidney in a game last year through sheer accident and coincidence, also got on board as an ambassador for the foundation. And then we asked Tony Abbott, the Minister for Health, to come on board. And look, no matter what side of politics your listeners are on out there, whether it be Labor or Lib, this man, Tony Abbott, has been a passionate supporter and a passionate man of helping more children and more adults get organ and tissue transplants. And he's been great for us.
People either love or hate Tony Abbott, but he's certainly been very, very good on this issue, hasn't he?
He has indeed. And only a few weeks ago, we did a major press conference in Sydney with Tony Abbott and John Alomo, the All Black rugby union legend, and he had a kidney transplant 3 years ago. Mm. And he was in the country, and he helped promote organ and tissue awareness, and he also agreed to be an ambassador for our foundation. But this year in round one, we had all the NRL teams wear the laces, and we're halfway through getting all the AFL teams to wear the laces, and we've had cricket teams, soccer teams, netball teams right throughout the country, and also into New Zealand. The campaign's reached to raise the awareness, and selling rainbow shoelaces that has now, we believe, become the national symbol for organ and tissue awareness.
You've also got a website that people should know about?
We have, John. It's ZAIDEE.org.
Right, so it's Zadie.org.
ZAIDEE.org. And for the listeners out there, the greatest thing is to talk to the family, but the second greatest thing is to get a registration form and fill out.
So how do you get that registration form?
They can download the information off our website.
Right.
Be directed to the places, or they can go to a Medicare or Medibank or many chemists that should have these registration forms. And to sign up is doesn't cost anything. It takes 5 minutes, but the greatest thing of all is that you could save the life of someone. In fact, it could be a relative of yours that you could save the life of, and everyone could be in that situation that needs a transplant eventually, and especially the 20 to 30 kids that die every year that don't get a transplant. That's what where our target is to make sure that these 20 to 30 kids do get the opportunity of having a transplant.
And just for the sake of signing a form,
yep,
you could turn that statistic around.
Yep.
Look, thank you so much for coming onto the program. We really appreciate you appearing on Dad's on the Air.
Well, look, thanks for the opportunity, John, and if anyone's walking past the athlete's foot or Midi's electrical, jump in and buy a pair of rainbow laces and whack in your shoes and reflect your support.
That was Alan Turner. He's the chief executive of the Zadie Rainbow Foundation. He's doing an absolutely amazing job promoting organ transplant. You can go to the website Zadie, ZADIDEE.org. You can download the forms that you need to register your family to donate organs. He's done an astonishingly moving story, and he has turned what was an appalling family disaster into an opportunity to help thousands and thousands of other Australians. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Cheers, John.
We'll be back in a moment.
Dad's on the Air starting to receive a lot of material, songs from all around the world, written by fathers and performed by fathers who are being denied contact with their children. This next song is one of those. It's written and performed by US serviceman Eric Birch. He's prevented from seeing two of his older children. We'll have Eric on the show on the 27th of August, which will be our Father's Day special.
He's been fighting in Iraq, hasn't he?
He's been fighting in Iraq, and he's very he makes the point that the US is quite prepared to send its men overseas to fight for the freedom in other countries. And while back at home, they do not allow them the freedom to have contact with their own children.
We'll be back.
This is one of his new songs. It's Don't You Need Love.
Can't you see? to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the right of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
Next up, we have John Ashfield from South Australia on the line. He's the author of a new book, Matters for Men, and quite a number of other books about men's issues. Are you there, John?
I am. How are you going?
Jolly good. Now, you actually work for the South Australian government working on men's issues, is that correct?
Yes, I have done, and I am currently. I'm mainly working in rural and regional South Australia, and most recently have been pretty much preoccupied with men's health and men's mental health in the drought conditions, of course, that farmers are experiencing over here. Well, and Australia-wide, of course.
And how are they doing?
I think they're doing remarkably well. I mean, one of the misconceptions, I think, is that men do more poorly than women when it comes to mental health. But in fact, when we look at the general prevalence rates for mental illness, for both genders, the figures are pretty much even. I mean, the real concern we have for men, particularly those that are isolated, and because, of course, men are four times as likely to die by suicide than women. But in general, men's mental health is holding up as well as that of women's.
Yeah, there is that myth that women talk and men crawl under a rock, and therefore that they're mental health suffers as a result of that sort of natural trait.
Well, it's I think that's an interesting misconception. If that were the case, we would probably be looking at a different statistic when it comes to depression, for example. Twice as many women experience depression as men. A good deal more women experience anxiety states than men. More women experience a post-traumatic stress disorder than men.
And why is that?
I think that very much has to do with different coping styles. You know, if we look at the profile of how men characteristically cope and how women characteristically cope, they do that in quite sex-specific or gender-specific ways. And for example, as I've said to you, the general prevalence rates for mental illness are much the same for men and for women. But with women, the standout issues are depression and anxiety, for example. And with men, men tend to abuse alcohol. They will tend to have some difficulties greater difficulties with chronic stress. And so the standout issues are different for both. But as I say, in general, men and women cope equally as well.
And are the issues that men are facing, are they significantly different in the rural and regional areas to what men face in the city?
Well, I think they are, and that's reflected in general health statistics and mental health statistics. I mean, men experience a greater degree of isolation that, for example, live in rural and, both regional, rural and remote areas. They have much less access to services. And of course, as we know, services in general, whether they're health services or mental health services, tend not to be that responsive to men's needs. They tend not to be particularly male-friendly effective in engaging men.
Yes, you walk into the doctor's surgery and there's nothing but domestic violence posters vilifying all men as abusers, basically, and it turns them off in droves, really, doesn't it?
Well, that's right. I mean, look, health services largely revolve around women and children's health needs and haven't always been very good at delivering services to men in an appropriate or an effective way. And, of course, successful processes are in place to engage and monitor the health of women and children. But it's only recently that there's been some interest by health services in genuinely grappling with their failure to engage men in a similarly effective way.
Look, does it work? You know, you go to the doctor these days and they give you this whole analysis that your body's like a car and it needs a regular tune-up and so on and so forth. Does that sort of simplistic way of relating to men. Is that working?
Well, look, some would say it does. I, to be honest, I've seen no analytical data that would suggest that, that those sort of, you know, techniques or gimmicks do work. I mean, it's interesting because in the region in which I work, and you'd be familiar with the Pit Stop program, what we have done is dispense with you know, that kind of model of the...
Look, for those who don't know it, can you just sum up what the Pit Stop program was?
Well, I don't know all that much about it, except that, of course, it developed in Western Australia, and it uses the notion of, you know, it uses the metaphor of the car and different things you might need to do for a car in terms of maintenance, checking tyres and oil and those sort of things. And
they go around to people's workplaces.
And they use that as a basis for engaging men. I personally, and this is my own personal opinion, but I find that quite demeaning. I don't think we need to deal with men as little boys, and I don't think we need to use gimmicks. I think that what we need to do is to find appropriate ways of communicating with men who are, in fact, quite responsive to health messages if they come in a male or a masculine form. I mean, I know it's stating the yawningly obvious, but men are not women. And yet so much communication, particularly that's used by government and health services, that is intended to engage with men, speaks to them as if they were women. But what we've got to do is get health messages out. And, of course, you know, the purpose of the book I've written is to get important health messages out to men in a form of language in a way that is masculine and, if you like, direct, constructive, even perhaps authoritative in some ways. And I've used humour as well, because men use humour very adaptively as a way of containing and managing and diffusing emotion in relation to, you know, issues that are perhaps important or telling. So we've got to find effective ways of communicating with men, and when we do that, we'll see a better response than we have in the past.
John, your book, The Making of Man, Reclaiming Masculinity and Manhood, in that you attempt to make sense of the issue of gender, masculinity and manhood, which have for decades been bedeviled by rigid gender ideology. In what way have we lost our masculinity?
Well, I mean, we've been pummeled and bludgeoned by an anti-male ideology now for decades, which basically emanates from gender feminism, and the message of which has been that we are basically substandard human beings, that we are psychologically inept, that you know, we need to comply with a female model of what it means to conduct relationships, of what it means to be a whole person, which I find utterly bewildering. But this is what we've been attacked with, and of course, you know, one of the central tenets and emphases of gender feminism is the need to demasculinize men and to feminize them. But of course, you know, the ironical thing about that, and this holds true, you know, over a period of decades, is that whilst feminists have demanded this of men, they haven't wanted to have relationships with men that are like that.
No, that's been the great thing, hasn't it? You know, exactly. The sort of the snags, you know, she's off with the the butch pool tiler while he's sort of sitting in the lounge room knitting or whatever the analogies
are.
That's
right. So, you know, by day they're saying one thing and by night they're doing another. I mean, it's been quite... And it was very interesting because, you know, the men's liberation movement in Britain, the early men's liberation movement, yeah, which in the most part doesn't exist now, but they went out of their way to conform in every way possible with, you know, the gender feminist agenda, so that they would be acceptable to women, and so that they, you know, would be seen as sympathetic to the cause. And they were still scorned and rejected, and yes, and I think some of them probably were very disillusioned by that. They expected it might, you know, ingratiate them to the very women that were attacking them, but if anything, the attack intensified.
So how do you see it revolving then from here? Do we go back to what it was?
I just don't think that's possible. You know, history's moved on, but I think what we have got to do is, you know, one of the things we've got to do is get back to the in my view, the evidence that we have, whether it's from anthropology or psychobiology and other sources, the real evidence for what it for that describes to us those behaviours that are particular to men and particular to women, the differences that exist between us, and work with those realities rather than pretending that that somehow men and women can be genderless and that the only differences between us are in sexual and reproductive functions. I mean, one of the problems with the gender feminist view of men and the idea that we need to become more like women is that it's completely detached from biological reality. That is, the reality of who we are and what we are as men and women. And of course, we, men and women, think and feel and behave in sex-specific ways, gender-specific ways, and that emanates from differences in biology, differences in the way our brains are structured, in the way they function, and in the way they interact with our hormonal systems. Now, there's an overwhelming weight of evidence and science to suggest that when it comes to human behaviour in general, biology is primary. And, of course, gender feminists have painted themselves in a corner over that because they basically said, no, you know, gender is entirely a social construct, or it's something that's constructed by people and culture. But in fact, in the most part, it's actually biologically based, and that's what the science is showing us now, and it's indisputable.
We're talking with John Ashfield. He's the author of a number of books, including The Nature of Men, Looking After Your Family, and his latest work, Matters for Men. He's a men's health expert working for the South Australian Government. We'll be back in a moment. Talking with John Ashfield. He's the author of a number of books, including Matters for Men, The Nature of Men, and Looking After Your Family. How did you get into writing all these books?
Well, someone had to do it. and I really, yes. You know, look, my experience at university was, a very rocky road. because I actually, one of the degrees I did was a social work degree, and I entered the fray with some of the most rabid feminists you could come across.
I did women's studies at Flinders University in the 1970s.
And, you survived.
Yes, I survived.
You're still here.
But it was, wasn't it? It was amazing.
Well, it was terribly difficult, and I found that... I remember going to one of my male lecturers, just prior to that, I'd been asked to actually generate a debate amongst students about some issues. Mm. And afterwards, I actually got hate mail from some of the feminist-oriented students. Mm. Went to my lecturer and said, all the university is about open discussion, exploring ideas, looking at evidence, weighing arguments. And he said, look, if I were you, I'd stay quiet.
Stay quiet.
Yeah. The male is really under attack, isn't it?
Absolutely. But it just disillusioned me, and it made me all the more determined to actually delve into a whole range of men's issues.
It's an absolute pack mentality that we've seen in all this. There's a fascinating new book out, which I thoroughly recommend people read, called What's Left, How Liberals Lost Their Way by Nick Cohen.
He
touches on a lot of these issues as to the incredible pack mentality between academics and journalists, and just how we have all thought alike, or the whole public culture has been so alike on this issue.
Mm, mm.
Just incredible. So, yeah, keep going, sorry.
No, there's some... I think there are... there's a greater boldness appearing in the press in general, and on the part of some authors as well. But one of the big problems we've got is that we've got a lot of pro-feminist males that are presuming to speak for men, who are really representing the gender feminist agenda.
Oh, yes, they make a living out of it. You know, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars are poured into all these various programs, and the men make a living out of running around preening and being a hero for the women.
And that's certainly true in academic institutions. I mean, it's worse in North America than it is in Australia, I would suggest, but it's still a serious problem here.
And it really distorts the debate, doesn't it? Because the journalists, and I've seen this so often, you know, a woman journalist will go to the male who echoes exactly her views,
exactly,
and quotes it as a male view.
That's quite right. Well, look, another reason why I wrote this most recent book, Matters for Men, is not only, as I say, to put out messages about health and on relationships and other issues, but I wrote the book because it was an opportunity to communicate to ordinary readers the unequivocal message that men have a lot to be proud of, and that to be a man is an honourable thing. And what I wanted to do was put out powerful messages about how men need to stand tall and strong and be unapologetically male and masculine. Mm. Men have always been the chief champions of justice, the lawmakers, the peacemakers, the philanthropists, and when needed, the self-sacrificing protectors of family and community. And they need to be proud of that, but by heck, they don't get much credit for it. And, the thing I find ironical, especially about of my academic colleagues, is that, the people sitting in air-conditioned offices, middle class, safe, superannuated, highly educated, pouring scorn on masculinity, are the very people that have most benefited from it and have benefited from men's disposability.
Yes, I like to ask the question, who was the first woman on the moon?
Well, feminists talk of equality, but do you really think they have any notion of what that would really mean? And they cherry-pick when it comes to what degree of equality they really want.
Yes, you don't see many women garbage collectors. You don't see many women in dangerous jobs. Yes, it is absolutely that.
Well,
yes,
look,
and it is so offensive, the overweening culture, this liberal culture that we've... I've just been obsessed by this book, Nick Cohen, lately. I just want to read a couple of sentences which really sort of sums this up, and that is that we've been the absolute victim of this collusion between a liberal identity and that the worst of it is the ludicrous liberal pretense that the traditional family doesn't matter and the consequences of that, and the traditional liberal pretense that men are abusive and bad for the family and that women and children are just not safe in the family. Is that...
Well, you know, I absolutely tire of hearing about, just to pick up on one issue you've mentioned there, that all men are potentially abusive. You know, I mean, how many of your listeners are aware of the fact that women perpetrate most physical abuse and neglect of children, including, lethal violence? And interestingly, that more often happens in relation to male children than female children. We know that women perpetrate as much partner violence as men, which has its impact on the family as well. But men are the ones that are so often depicted as the abusers.
Do you think the Just Say No campaign in Australia, violence against women, Australia says no to violence, do you think that's been a counterproductive campaign and it's dishonest portrayal of domestic violence?
I think it's counterproductive because it's dishonest, and I think it's also quite squalid statistically. We have the evidence that's out there about domestic violence would suggest a quite different picture. Now, that's not to say that some men don't abuse some women, but some women abuse some men. And I think that when we start to cast men, all men in one category as abusers, we're running into serious trouble. And so I think it's quite dishonest, misleading, and quite reprehensible. I think a lot of men are deeply offended by it, and I think, yes, it is counterproductive. I think, if anything, what it does is undermine the great sympathy that by far the majority of men have for women who do experience gratuitous violence from their partners.
There's also the Little Pinky campaign that the RTA's been funding lately that encourages people to wave their little finger at people who are speeding or driving badly, which is completely sexist, and it completely ignores the fact that some women drive badly as well.
Well, that's certainly my experience. But I just think that in general we've got to begin to arrest, you know, the madness of political correctness, which it just generalises itself in all sorts of absurd ways. It's a problem. And I think the other thing is that I'm not sure that people realise the extent to which what we call political correctness actually emanates or originally emanated out of the whole ethos and culture of gender feminism originally.
Yeah, if we just get back to the issue of mental health that we were talking about before, there's actually an article in this morning's Sydney Morning Herald entitled It's the Things We Don't Know That Matter, written by David Crosby, and if you'll just bear with me, I'll just read a couple of paragraphs from it. This week, the Mental Health Council of Australia released a report into the first 6 months of the new Medicare Benefit Schedule program, which aims to increase access to GPs, psychologists and health professionals for those with mental health problems. This is the largest single measure in mental health reform in the past decade. It will cost more than $500 million in the first 5 years. Women aged between 25 and 50 have been the greatest beneficiaries of these new measures. Of the $78 million spent on rebates, $52 million went to women. Young men have been the least likely to be referred to a psychologist, despite the evidence that this group is most at risk of suicide and the development of serious mental health problems. The only age group where males have outnumbered females has been boys aged from 5 to 14. This may be because most mothers take their boys to GPs to address behaviour-related issues. Yeah, so that would tend to back up the fact that, like as you said earlier, that in terms of the statistics, men and women are pretty much equal in terms of mental health problems, but the funding seems to be going, you know, fairly biasedly, mostly towards women, ignoring the most at-risk group of young men.
Oh, absolutely. Look, and historically, the fact is considerably less money has been spent specifically on men's health. And of course, we have no national men's health policy or plan, and it would seem that at every turn, men's health is evidently a fairly low priority. It's interesting, particularly in relation to suicide, because I would challenge anybody who suggest that we have even begun to understand the phenomenon of male suicide, which is hugely telling, given that men are four times more likely to die by suicide than women. But we hardly even understand the phenomenon.
John, we're out of time. Just very quickly, how do people get in contact, or how do people get onto your books, basically?
Well, basically what they can do is, if they go to, there's a website.
Peacock
Publications, yes, www.peacockpublications, one word, .com.au. And if they click on new releases, they'll see my books there all in one column.
Right, and they include Matters for Men, The Nature of Men, Looking After Your Family, and a number of other titles.
Yeah, they're all there, and they're all economically priced as well.
Good. Look, John, I wish we'd had you on earlier. What a fantastic interview you are. All right, we'll hopefully have you on again onto Dad's on the Air at another time.
Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Yes, thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Here's another song from the US serviceman Eric Birch.
Siehe, wir hassen, wir streiten. Es trennt uns Neigung und Meinung. Aber es bleichet indes dir sich die Locke wie mir.
Crime's code. the part of us that failed to live, failed to live, failed to live.
We have Tom Mock on the line for a new section that we're running here called Research Central. Are you there, Tom?
Yeah, hi, John. How are you going?
Good. Now, what have you got for us today?
I'm discussing a paper titled Deconstructing the Essential Father.
Right, and what?
By Silverstein and Auerbach. That was originally published in the Journal of American Psychologists, June 1999.
Right, so it's fairly old. Why would we be looking at it now?
Well, it seems to have been a response to the Essentialists.
Right, whatever and, that means.
Well, the Essentialists fundamentally state... I'll just read from here, and for your listeners' benefit, if they do a Google... search Deconstructing the Essential Father.
Yeah, and this has been quite an influential paper.
Oh, hugely influential.
Right.
In fact, it sort of draws to the essence of feminist sociology and feminist psychology versus medical sociology and medical psychology.
Okay.
But anyway, the term essential in Essential Father refers to the concept of essentialism. That is, the idea that there are biological sex differences between men and women that create a difference in parenting methods and emphases between the genders. Feminists believe that this concept of separate spheres has been discredited since the turn of the last century. And why this paper's been hugely influential is because it's somewhat been the reference point for those sociologists who argue that fatherlessness per se is not a problem for children.
No, and you see this as a really common argument, isn't it? That the it's a sort of elite opinion, really, that fathers do not matter.
Well, we do. We know that fathers matter, but the elite opinionists posit that it's because of economic deprivation with father absence that there are health impacts on children. And, of course, this is the whole paradigm of the Australian Child Support Agency.
That all the problems are just money and they turn you into a wallet and take your money and that's all the purpose that you really need.
Well, yeah.
To serve.
More or less. And then I'll just... So in terms of this paper,
yeah.
Just to conclude so that we can go on with the debate, in the end, and this is in reference to the researchers who wrote the paper Deconstructing Essential Father, they examine why the neoconservative perspective has become so widely accepted within popular culture. They then offer social policy recommendations that support men in their fathering role without discriminating against women and same-sex couples. Now, this paper was hugely influential in convincing the Victorian Labor government to allow IVF for same-sex couples.
Right, that they really, you know, that two mums, well, we don't really know the answer to this, but to support the argument that that kids don't need dads in real life.
Yeah, that those roles are interchangeable.
And that for a single woman to use IVF is a perfectly valid thing to do.
Yeah, and those who would argue against fatherlessness, that it can be ameliorated through social policy, really aren't reading the current literature that's coming out.
And the current literature is all supporting the fact, isn't it, that fathers play an absolutely fundamental part in kids' lives?
Yes and no. Yes, in terms of social consequences for children, but no in terms of the word essential in the paper Deconstructing Essential Father, in that a new model of family research has evolved, written by Booth, called the biosocial model. So most of the work that's going on in this country is purely in terms of a sociological paradigm, but most of the work that's going on in the Northern Hemisphere includes biological and medical markers. So, for instance, there's some work going on at the moment in North America by James Swain, S-W-A-I-N. And he's a medical doctor, but has access to a new imaging process called functional magnetic resonance imaging. And for your listeners who are interested in this, if they go into Google Scholar and type in James Swain's name, they'll start to read some of the abstracts that are available online on the sort of work that he's doing. But effectively what he's done in a recent paper published this year is photographed, and I say photographed, John, the brain circuitry of parenting. Now it seems that that brain circuit of parenting is common to both fathers and mothers. But furthermore, he's photographed a brain circuitry for mothering as a unique brain circuitry. And I believe that his further work that's going to be published in the not-too-distant future is to publish photographs of the unique paternal brain circuitry.
Right, and so that basically you're saying that the kid's brain responds differently to mum to dad.
Yeah, and the way that's expressed through, say, paternal behaviour is specifically related to play.
And also, with women having so few children, I think one of the arguments is that these sections of the brain that are lighting up in parental brains for women is an obsessive sort of protective area of the brain.
Well, James Swain's identified that the maternal brain circuitry is the same brain circuitry in obsessive-compulsive disorder.
Right, and why would that be?
Well, because mothers have to be obsessive and compulsive in terms of providing that protection
for their
children.
To protect their child.
In the early years, but prior to medical intervention in terms of maternal morbidity and death rates, mothers were having many, many more children.
Right. So look,
it's gone.
Sorry, we're out of time. Yeah. Sorry. It goes very fast, 10 minutes.
All right, well, look, I'd like to pick up maybe in a couple of weeks on the clinical implications for some of this work.
That'll be great. Sorry, yep. Tom has been pestering us for some months to say that we should have a more solid research base for some of the work that we do on Dads on the Air, and we've taken the point on board and we've introduced this new segment, Research Central, which Tom Mock will be bringing to us each fortnight. Thank you very much for your contribution to Dads on the Air, Tom.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Bye.
We'll be back.
You were born to be free and was meant to share a life with me. And it all turned out bad and ended so sad. But it was nothing to do with me and you. And as time went by, I struggled and fought with the law. I'm a forlorn and forgotten man, and they took all my dignity. But they can't stop me loving you. No, they won't stop me loving you. For the real love, the dare not speak its name. And I'll never stop trying, even though I am tiring. For the chance to see you again. Have gone by, and the fight for your rights doesn't seem to get any easier. But the love in my heart burns stronger each day, and I won't give up trying to be with you. And I pray for the day when the pain goes away, and I just get to see you. Stop me loving you. No, they won't stop me loving you. For the real love, the dare not speak its name. And I'll never stop trying, even though I am tiring. For the chance, the chance to see you again.
Chance.
to see you again.
And we have on the line Harry Hill. He's the author of a new book, He Was My Father. Welcome to the show.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, we're fine. We're good. Rocking along. Right. Now, Harry, you're 80, I think, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, good on you. And still going.
Not a chicken anymore.
Not a chicken anymore. And your father was a school teacher in Tumut.
I was the school teacher.
You were the school teacher.
Yeah, yeah.
And your father?
Right. He was a labourer. He was a shearer.
Right.
Much flasher.
And you wrote this very interesting book about what it was like, basically, growing up in the Depression in the Alpine areas of Australia.
That's right, yes.
And what was it like?
It was wonderful. It was the best years of my life. There were too few before my father died. But he was a returned serviceman, a digger, and a great bloke. And I remember him with great fondness. But he died when I was 11. But I still remembered quite a lot about him.
And why did you put this book together?
I'm interested in history, and I'm interested in my own kids and my grandkids. A couple of years back, I thought they never knew him, they never knew what he put up with, and so I thought, I'll write it. And I printed just a few copies for for family, showed it to a publisher, book publisher that I knew, and he said, this is worth turning into a book for the market, generally.
So that was Cilla Rosenberg.
Yeah, that was right.
Yeah, she's a lovely person.
Yeah. So it ended up, with their help, as being a book that came out. And I was very pleased with it.
Now, how do people get onto it?
Well, they can contact me.
Yeah.
I'd imagine it's available generally in stores now, or Rosenberg Press.
Rosenberg Press. Yeah. They do a lot of small Australian publishing and small print run stuff. They do a marvellous job.
Only a day or two back, and she said David was working on a new book.
Rosenberg Publishing.
He
Was My Father. Now, I remember you talking about just growing up, you know, when there were times when there was nothing to eat but just pumpkin skins and stuff like that.
Yeah, I hate pumpkin. I hate pumpkin, but these were days out on the hill farm when Dad was still alive. He was working the farm for his brother, who was an invalid. And as a kid, I used to go out and spend wonderful times there, rabbiting. And sometimes Dad was when we were there, Dad fed us, the two boys. And sometimes food was a bit scarce. And I can remember we had one night boiled pumpkin. And I don't like pumpkin. And he said, put pepper on it, it makes it better. It was worse. But that was Depression days.
My grandmother.
35.
My grandmother had never let us leave the table till we'd eaten the pumpkin skin. We'll ate it.
Oh, no, but we weren't ever allowed to leave anything on our plate, even if it was horrible stuff.
No, that's very much the Depression, isn't it?
Yes.
Waste not, want not.
Yes.
So, do you think a lot of this has been lost?
I do, and yet it's amazing how much of it is coming to light now. Only, I think it was last month, I was looking at TV, and here is the Governor-General and the Queen at the 90th anniversary of the Battle of Passchendaele in Flanders. And that's where my father copped his fifth wounding that put him out of action, that he was repatriated back to Australia. And here it was, vivid pictorial countryside that looked absolutely peaceful, beautiful, and yet he went through Passchendaele, and that's where he copped it. I think every time he stuck his head up, the Germans shot him.
Yes, a lot of your generation, their fathers were killed or very severely wounded in World War One.
In that, within a day or two, his battalion lost about 50% of its men, either killed, gassed, missing, wounded, and the Australian 3rd Division, I think, lost over 30,000 in one attack.
Dear, oh dear.
Yeah.
So you were a school teacher in a small country town for many years.
Quite a few country towns.
Quite a few. Yeah. What do you think about the whole situation now? Is the country going to the dogs or what?
No. One has to be realistic and realise the change is happening. But there's so much of what was country life 60 years ago that I think was important. And so I am very happy to spend part of my time documenting it. Because I know my grandchildren have been interested in the story about their great grandfather, and many other people are too, not just my children. And I think there is a movement back towards now of Australian history as being important. And even though it's only pertaining to one person, it's a story that has to be told.
And how would you sum up just the influence of your own father? You were only 11 when he died. Yep. Your own father in your life, what would you say?
Of great importance to me. If I imagine or think of what would be the typical Australian ex-serviceman, person who lived through the Depression, uncomplaining about it, it's my father. And so I'm very proud to have his name, and very proud for people who knew my father, that when they saw me, they'd say, "Oh, you're Harry Hill's son," and I'd say, "Yep, I am."
In a way, it's your life story as well, isn't it, Harry?
Well,
and you've lived through it, being 80. You've lived through a hell of an interesting time in history, really, from horse and cart to the man on the moon to computers to colour television. All those none of those things were there 80 years ago.
No, not even wireless.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, I can remember when we got our first wireless. It was about the same time that my father had a big pile of possum skins. This was Depression. He had a big pile of possum skins that somehow or other he'd managed to snare, and he definitely had a market for the skins, but it was illegal. But I remember going, well, I can't remember. I can remember my mother being told, "Shut your son up," because I'd gone to school and said, "Dad's got this big pile of possum skins." And the teacher said, "Tell your son to shut up." because it was what a person had to do in those days if you wanted to feed a family.
That's an incredible story. Harry, you've documented a lot of the life down there, and you've written a number of books. We've run out of time now, unfortunately, to list all of them, but you've written quite a number of books on the local history down in the Tumut and the Alpine area of Australia.
Yeah.
Look, congratulations on the new book, He Was My Father, which is available through Rosenberg Publishing.
Yes.
And look, thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air.
Oh, very pleased to. You still call it Dad's, even though people are granddads?
Oh, yes, of course. Dad's once a dad, always a dad, aren't you?
Yeah, I dare say.
You know, I dare say, yes.
Yeah.
All right. Look, thank you so much, Harry.
That's all right. Thanks for being interested.
No, thank you.
Goodie-out.
Thank you.
So that was Harry Hill. He's the author of a new book, He Was My Father, which can be bought through Rosenberg Publishing. We'll be back next week with all the news and views from the conference, the Lone Fathers Conference down in Canberra, which asked the question, has Howard's family law reforms been a success? We think the answer is a resounding no.
We're Dads on the Air, we're here 'cause we care. We ask